You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. At the third annual World Social Forum in Porto Alegre, Brazil, the topics range from the lack of affordable housing in the U.S. to the media, the violence in Venezuela, to the Israeli occupation of Palestine. The attendees at this roundtable included Justin Podour of Z Magazine, Rahul Mahajan, author of The New Crusade, author Barbara Ehrenreich, who wrote Nickeled and Dimed, Palestinian rights activist Hassan Barghouti, and professor and foreign policy commentator Robert Jensen of the University of Texas, just to name a few.
There is a lot of war crime happening to us, you know. Until now, 55 years, we are waiting for the implementation of the UN resolution. You see, I believe the question is if we can really mobilize people to visit Baghdad and to move to visit Palestine, and people to start writing from Baghdad to the newspapers, the TVs, or the radio, or maybe we can really build a kind of a network, you know, to write from Baghdad to United States of America, to mobilize more and more people, to not just to stay and talk and talk and talk. To do something.
I agree that it's a great idea to try and get people from other countries to write letters, but if we at home can't get the media to cover some of these where there's 100,000 people, where there's 4,000 people, then how are we going to get them to read the letters, the couple hundred that come in?
I think we're exaggerating the closure of the U.S. media. It's never been more open on an anti-war issue since the Vietnam era. And Americans who go to Iraq and write about it are getting coverage. When Sean Penn went, of course, he's a big celebrity. Sean Penn got oodles of media coverage off of his visit. He was on Larry King. He did all the things that big celebrities do. And even much lesser people are getting published in the paper. So this is it's exactly the wrong time to be pessimistic about what you can get in the media. But one point I just wanted to say very quickly is I think Adele's mentioning Venezuela is very important because it seems to me if you want to put the weakness of the American anti-war movement in a nutshell, put it in one sentence, it's the fact that they're paying no attention to what's going on in Venezuela, which is frankly of roughly equal geopolitical significance with what's going on in Iraq and also caused by the United States. And also something where in the case of Iraq, you're just trying to prevent an atrocity. In the case of Venezuela, there's something very hopeful going on that could be allowed to continue if the United States took more interest in it. So I think that linkage has got to be very much part of what we do when we talk about the war, and we have to make sure that people do understand that it's way beyond some question of, you know, just how is it going to affect me today and tomorrow.
I'm going to jump in and make two points that kind of bounce off some points that were made previously. One on yours, Omar. I believe that although it would be nice to be, that we could actually change U.S. foreign policy to the point where it could turn something that could actually liberate other countries, it's not going to happen. And I agree with you, we can't have those illusions. But what I would like to see in the United States is kind of breaking down the illusions that we could turn the Bush administration into a positive force for good, but make United States citizens aware of their potential for, you know, through direct action, through solidarity, for strengthening liberation movements. We can't change the Bush administration into a good. We can only hope to defeat them, but we can't change them into a good force. But our labor unions can you know, our longshoremen can, you know, could conceivably refuse to unload Israel's goods when they're shipped over here. That's something that would strengthen the hand of Palestinians conceivably. And on the other thing that Barb brought up, as far as the beginning point for organizing in the U.S. for depot organizing, for class-based organizing, it'd be also very wonderful if people could just oppose the war because it's wrong to go mess with Iraq. However, as a starting point of the conversation, you know, I work at the Coalition on Homelessness, $400 billion for war and $29 million for all the assorted human services is a very good place to start a conversation with somebody who's working for minimum wage, who's being laid off or working three jobs just to make ends meet. That's a very good place to to start the conversation. $14 million a day that goes to Israel. If we took all of, you know, the $14 million that we spend, multiply that by 365, we could pretty much end homelessness in the entire United States. That would be double that of a current piece of progressive legislation going through Congress called the National Affordable Housing Trust Fund. We could do something like, you know, 2 million homes over 10 years, you know, and completely subsidize it. And that's a very good way of starting the conversation. Again, we don't want to end it there because we don't want people just to act out of their own selfish, well, I could get a house, so don't bomb Iraq. But it's a good place to start.
To go back to the media issue and to Venezuela, I think that one of the big things that's coming out of Venezuela from people who have been there and from people who are part of the Bolivarian movement is the way the media in Venezuela is a protagonist in the coup attempts and so on. And one of the things that the movement in Venezuela has done has been to try to establish community media. I mean, there's Alo Presidente, there's a certain amount of state media that basically shows you the diametric opposite of what the private media does. But they're trying to set up a third, you know, a kind of a community media sector with community radio stations and some independence from the state that's you know, more linked to the more organic movements. And I think that, you know, that's an important question for, you know, for North Americans as well. You know, like, Barbara, you write a lot for the mainstream media, and then there's a lot of folks who work for Zenad and indie media. So I think talking about, you know, the relationship between the two, KPFK, and the relationship between trying to get into the mainstream and trying to build independent media is a good one.
I think also another aspect that has been left out of the anti-war movement and didn't even come up today was Colombia. We need to make the links between what's going on in Colombia and Venezuela and Iraq and Afghanistan and Palestine and all over, because those are parts of U.S. foreign policy as well. Having that kind of, there were reports recently of atrocities committed by paramilitaries, which are directly linked to the government and to U.S. funding. I mean, it's an easy linkage to make if there was enough media coverage. And that, too, as part of, I mean, they directly linked the issue of terrorism with Colombia and made that yet another flashpoint on the so-called war on terror. So I think that that has to absolutely also be another place where we as anti-war activists extend the you know, solidarity and very much make it a part of our analysis.
Going back to your comment on the media, I agree that a lot of things are covered, but I don't think they're covered to the extent of even raising the issue for somebody, where they would read it and take the interest to go research it. Back to your point, I just don't think people are educated enough. I don't think they honestly really know what's going on. When I talk to the majority of people, like, on a college campus, they have no idea why we're even going to war. That is so sad. And I couldn't imagine, I mean, trying to, like, get everything, I agree, like, getting into the media could be one way of education, but trying to get people to get that into the media when they don't even really know what's going on. I mean, when I watch things on CNN, the news that everybody watches, they're having protests in Venezuela. Nothing about why. I mean, you have no idea. And some people get a spark of interest, but yeah. But most people still have no idea what's going on.
Actually, we can discuss ad nauseum about what we need to do. And I feel like we're living in a somewhat idealistic state of mind right now because, okay, so we need to connect this to global justice. We need to connect this to Colombia, to Venezuela, to Afghanistan, to Palestine. Yes, I agree with you. Have you tried to do all this in a public speaking event when you're faced with an audience that knows nothing? When you're faced with an audience that doesn't even know where Iraq is on the map, you know, and that thinks that Iraq is composed of 22 million Saddam Husseins. And when you go into that audience and you're starting from that point and then you're trying to connect it to Colombia and all they know about Colombia is drug lords and all they know about Venezuela is nothing. So I think what we need to be doing, what I would really appreciate, is if we can strategize as to how we could accomplish this. We don't have a megaphone. We barely have access to the media, although we do have greater access than we used to, but we still, our access, I feel, it's like darts at a window. So yes, we hit it, but we still have this massive window. So how do we do this? How do we do this in the organizing that we are doing? And I have to say, we are doing massive organizing, especially the organizing that we in North Carolina have managed to do just these past 4 months exceeds the organizing that we have been able to do since I've lived in North Carolina for 16 years. But how do we do this?
But I just want to say, I think college campuses are a really important place to start. The last 2 weeks was a phenomenal, the amount of media coverage we got in the last 2 weeks, there was a peace encampment. There's different strategies that you can do, especially on a college campus, and the length of the conversations has, tripled in terms of, making the connections. And we've had teach-ins in the last month, two or three, and constantly, full room, 200 to 250. People want to know. This isn't... We have to approach it as not like they're a bunch of ignorant people. It's like there's
another 9/11. In fact, we're just not going to have another 9/11. We're going to have tens of them because it's people have got they've got the weapons and they know how to use them and they've done it once and they'll do it again. If not to the United States, they'll do it to Italy, they'll do it to France, they'll do it to Germany. So what I'm saying is not the issue is not convincing people that the war is not right. The issue is convincing people that it's actually within their power to stop it. Because, at the end of the day, people, so many times, I talk to people and they say, oh, there's nothing you can do about changing the system. And I tell them, well, what do you think the system is? And then they go like, oh, I says, do you think it's just something out there which you've got, which you don't contribute to? The system is a set of rules that we create. So we create the rules, we change them. I think that's the biggest message you're going to get out to people there. There's nothing predetermined about the way things are going in the world. So long as you can get people to be convinced of the fact that you can actually change things, then, I'm not saying it will happen automatically, but I think the biggest thing to win is the kind of hopeless feeling of, oh, I won't be able to do anything. And I think the way to do that is not just to get big media visibility, and it's really sort of becoming close to people and sort of talking them, almost on a one-to-one basis even, small groups. And then once you start with small groups, then these people are convinced, and then they go out and talk to other people, and these other people go out and talk to other people. And anti-organizing can be anything. There are many different ways. In Italy, the Disobbedienti have done amazing stuff. Fairly small things, but they started off with and they've just become so incredibly effective in their actions. And they've not only just focused on anti-war. They've taken a sort of broader stance. For them, war as global justice is... exploitation and stuff. These people have come there and they've disassembled a whole center that was meant to keep immigrants in there. They've just disassembled the whole place at night. They've gone in there. They've gone into the factories that sell the caterpillars to the Israeli government to just pull down the Palestinian houses. And they've literally covered them in with red sprays, and they've kind of assaulted the whole place without exerting any violence in them, but in a very, very sort of aggressive way. And they've started, taking actions against banks that finance armed trade. Because people, for example, a lot of people, they've got money in a bank. They do not realize that their money goes straight into paying for, cruise missiles or whatever, or landmines. I wouldn't want my money to go into landmines. I would feel bored by that, and people do not know it. So it's just very different front. It has to be a lot more pervasive than just simply big marches and big organizing.
When I ask about Saddam Hussein, so I'm not, I think everybody here knows all about imperialism. I grew up in a military school all my life. I received that every single day. The School of America's ideology, so this is the thing. And in my point of view, when I have read the newspapers in Brazil, Bush is saying, we are going to build a democracy in Iraq. How do we face this speech, this idea? Because everybody knows Saddam Hussein is not good for Iraq. Let's strengthen the movement against war and let people from Iraq to take the power over Saddam Hussein. Okay, but it has to be said clearly in our movement, not only against the war, against the war, against the war. Because when I saw this huge movement, I'd like to see, clearly who is the person that go to the demonstrators. Is someone that is caring about Iraq and people in Iraq, or only thinking about, oh my gosh, this war will waste a lot of money and we will lose our public service, you know what I mean? So how to, you know, how to tell them, you know, and that we are fighting not only for a war, against the war, but for the people in Iraq. And you give a good peace. So let people fight for democracy in Iraq. But it has to be said clearly in our movement. You know, and I'm not hearing this in Brazil. I am not here.
There's an easy rejoinder to it. In fact, in the United States, Christopher Hitchens, I don't know how many people outside of the U.S. have heard of him, but he's very illogical sometimes, but he's an absolute master of rhetoric and polemic. And he's been just painting everyone who says that as completely idiotic. And in part, he's right. There are no movements in Iraq which are going to liberate them. There's no such thing. Saddam Hussein crushed them. That's what you do when you create a totalitarian state. You crush all organs that are not of the state. There is nothing in Iraq that is not directly derived from the state. There is no chance that they can that they can change things until Saddam dies, and then presumably there's going to be a crazy power struggle in Iraq. That's true. I mean, one has to understand that if the United States goes in and removes Saddam Hussein, whatever regime they put in, it's going to be bad. It's going to have all kinds of problems. But there's going to be some ways in which it's better than Saddam's regime.
Sure, but then...
They will build democracy as Afghanistan.
They won't build democracy. No.
But they're saying that.
We have a perfect rejoinder to that, which is that he's destroying democracy in the United States.
Yeah.
You know, no, democracy is not a goal here. In fact, I just want to underscore that without getting paranoid, but it's very important that there be this international anti-war movement, because we may increasingly, especially when hostilities break out, lose our ability to dissent. We've never seen anything like what has happened since 9/11. This recent Supreme Court ruling that an American citizen can be held without being charged indefinitely for being a, quote, enemy combatant, with only the government defining you as an enemy combatant, it's unprecedented. It's the end of our Constitution. So there's nothing they can say on this democracy issue. Nothing. We have been moving increasingly toward dictatorship. And I think we need some recognition of that from the rest of the world, that not only do most Americans oppose the war, but, you know, we are losing so much so fast, not just schools, hospitals, and so on, but what the rights that we were so proud of that we thought defined us as Americans.
No, the only thing I wanted to comment on is, do we know how many dictatorships are there around the world today? More or less, roughly. Just as bad as Saddam Hussein's.
More or less?
10, 12, 15, doesn't matter. Are we going to bomb them all? I mean, this just doesn't logically make any sense, right? I mean, that's also another way to sort of rebut the whole let's liberate the Iraqi people. If we're liberating the Iraqi people with bomb, we should be liberating the North Koreans with bomb. We should be liberating
the Saudi Arabians.
We should be liberating the Cubans. We should be liberating, you know, let's just start listing them. There's so many.
That's a good argument, because
they can say, well, we're going to do one
thing at a time.
But in fact,
we're liberating the Iraqis. That's essentially what they do when that argument comes up. But I think, you know, the assault on democracy in the United States, the assault on democracy in Venezuela, if they want to build democracy in Iraq, why are they trying to tear it down in Venezuela? That's a kind of obvious rhetorical point that I think people can appreciate.
Well, they'll tell you that Chavez is non-democratic.
That's true, they will. Okay.
Not to be overly pessimistic, but as I fight to organize against the war, the disobedience actions are very inspiring. But what power do we have to stop this war, especially with the increasing closure of spaces of opposition?
We've had in Italy a march of 3 million people in March this year against for labor rights. 3 million people out of a population of 55. If you do the proportion in the United States with 400 million people, 200 million people, that would be like such a big number. You've never seen anything like that before. So in proportion, it was humongous. Okay. That didn't change anything at all. Why? Because we're not hurting them in their interests. We should aim at hitting them at the heart of their economic interests, because all they're interested in is money and richness. And so we should try and find a way of hitting them right where it counts. Ideally, what would be the best way of doing it? General strikes. You do one general strike one day, 2 weeks later you do another one, and then you just go on strike until they decide not to do the war. That's the kind of idea. We've got ethical banks. They've got a charter whereby they do not invest in any arms trade. And loads of people have taken their money out of commercial banks and brought it into ethical banks. That could be a way. They could send us a clear economic signal.
Excellent.
Well, you could have the argument, well, take just one thing at a time. I don't think you can say you're fighting for people when you go bomb people. I don't, like, when I personally look at how war has developed, you had ground troops that used to be on the ground that would fight soldiers. When you go and bomb people, you go and bomb civilians. You don't have where it's, you're fighting soldiers. It becomes unethical. I mean, you can't make that argument. You can't say we're going to go into Venezuela and liberate them by bombing them. If, I mean, and it doesn't make sense that we would be liberating Iraq because of how many people are killed by the sanctions right now. Those killed people.
Everybody and thinks they liberated Afghanistan. I mean, just...
Yeah.
Everybody thinks the United States liberated Afghanistan. Everybody thinks they built democracy in
Vietnam.
I mean, it's... Nobody thinks they liberated Vietnam.
But I've heard people straight up tell me exactly what you said. We are going to liberate Iraq by bombing their cities. Straight face, and they don't realize...
That's the point that you have to make, though. Like, you're bombing people.
But
like, you're not...
But there are people who truly agree with that. Truly. We're going to liberate them by bombing their cities.
When I was thinking about the sanctions and how the U.S. was killing their efforts for democracy, or that Saddam Hussein was killing their movements for democracy... I think the sanctions did that a lot as well, just by how many people it's been killing. I mean, people that are just worrying about getting medicine or just getting food, it's really hard for them to have a movement, to have democracy. So, just to
I'm asking myself one question, you know, that nowadays it's very clear that the Iraqi leadership forget the south, the north of Europe, and they centralize all of their forces in Baghdad, and as they declared it, make it very clear that Baghdad it will be the how to say it, the castle where the American forces will die here. What if Saddam Hussein use chemical or biological weapons against the American military forces? What the reaction? Of course, the first war in 19 against Iraq, Bush the father, he was very clear, he threat, in case of attacking us with chemical or another kind of weapons, we will destroy Iraq. What if Saddam Hussein, he's a dictator, he is a criminal, he is, and we want to invade his country, the main city, Baghdad, and we don't take care or think about it. In case if he attack us, of course they will attack him, which it means that millions of civilians will die in Baghdad.
That's what's so great about the inspections. The United States can disarm Iraq before they attack.
I just wanted to respond a little bit to what you said, Barbara, about how we're losing our constitutional rights. Just to say that, you know, talking about Colombia or Venezuela, especially Colombia, Colombia has one of the most progressive constitutions in the world. It was ratified in 1991. Indigenous rights are enshrined. The rights of Afro-Colombians to territorial autonomy are enshrined. And since 91 is actually when about 2 million people have been displaced. So I just, you know, I there is a difference between what happens on the ground and what is in the Constitution, and that can work against you as it does in Colombia. And I think it doesn't actually need, you know, just because they're passing all these bizarre laws in the U.S., that doesn't mean that they can actually pull them off if the political forces are against them or the social forces are against them. So.
I want to actually start out by asking some of the folks who are not Americans here what they would like to see from Americans. I believe that as Americans we carry probably the greatest responsibility living as we do on the soil of the world's largest superpower and the biggest aggressor. What is expected of us from Europe, from Latin America, from Africa, from the other continents? What is expected of us, and how can we most effectively, you know, carry these out. And I want to also talk a little bit about what Adela was saying with respect to some of the actions that have been carried out in Europe and the amazing marches. Now, I think you're absolutely right when you said that, you know, no matter how many people, and it is very significant for hundreds of thousands of people to march in the United States, but at the same time, no matter how many people come out, when it comes time for real change, are they really threatening the system as it stands? Do marches really threaten the system as it stands? And I may be opening a can of worms here when I start talking about this, but there is a debate going on in the United States ever since Seattle of 1999 between, you know, how one commences nonviolent actions and what are called violent actions, such as breaking a you know, Starbucks window, and really raising the costs for you know, for the elite, really raising the cost for the powerful, hurting it, you know, really hitting it where it hurts. And that does involve doing a little bit of property damage. In fact, maybe a lot of property damage in a peaceful way. There is this debate where I think we, on the left, have crippled ourselves a little bit in consuming ourselves with this and not understanding that those kinds of actions can happen on multiple levels, that those who want to pursue the peaceful, nonviolent marches can do so. And then there might be room. I mean, I don't know. I'm not completely convinced either way. But I think that we do, in the United States, need to take it a step higher. I have, you know, relatives from India who say, yeah, when, you know, when Indians get pissed off, they get pissed off. They'll carry a stick and they will smash store windows, and they will, you know, they will express the injustice, and they will attack things where they, you know, where they really matter. I mean, people will like get really upset and they won't hesitate. And we get incredibly tame in the United States and incredibly afraid of being labeled terrorists, incredibly afraid of being labeled terrorist and violent by our own movement. I think personally there's some way we need to break out of that. I don't know if I have the guts to go and do anything like that. But not only does that raise the stakes, it also can effectively increase media attention, although it can sometimes pervert it.
Yeah. But do you think that this is... But you succeed to recruit more and more people to be with you?
I don't know.
Or maybe any this kind of... This way of struggle, maybe any keep people away from you?
I don't know.
And you stay alone.
Yeah, it's. But I think we do need to discuss tactics and strategies here, and make figure out how to globalize those, especially at a place like this where we have that opportunity.
Thanks to Sonali Kolhatkar at Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles for that piece. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. by Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is Granger Helvey. We had production assistance from Adil Hamad of KPFA and Benta Brooklyn. Thanks to Pete Caracas, RadioForAll.net, and Shane Rock at WebActive.com for web help. Special thanks also to our consulting producers, Larry Binsky and Sam Husseini. Copies of this program can be ordered from the Pacifica Radio Archives by visiting the website at pacificaarchives.org or by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. If you'd like to support this type of programming, we urge you to visit pacifica.org and make a pledge through our secure online website. Or you can send your donations to Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. That's 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. You can send us your feedback to peacewatch@pacifica.org. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.